Chapter 13. The Mood is a Full Baboon. It was 12:30. A 900,081cc Harley-Davidson Mitsubishi Cranston Thurbid black leather-bound, steel-studded City of Angels bike iron-throated its way up the Pauntley Drive of 204 Bristol Avenue, South Brentwood, L.A., California. "Shit," drawled David. "That's Peter." Being laid back, obligatory in Southern California, I allowed the customary 20-minute pause to elapse before responding with, "Pon my soul, tis." We allowed another 20 minutes of laid-back time to pass before expecting to hear the doorbell. Zzz, it clanged. Both parties, either side of the door, alpha-rhythmed away a further third of an hour. Finally, after a series of languid phone calls, we managed to get through to Starlight Emergency 24-hour luxury door-opening service. We'd used them before. They were a good firm, and for a pittance of $1,000 a week, would arrive within minutes to open anyone's doors. There was, of course, a $50 surcharge for not being in the Beverly Hills area, but in addition to their activities with portals, they would remove any unwanted single-portion pizzas under 1 meter in width. David gave them a Mexican gardener as a tip and showed Peter in. Peter Bromelo, 6 feet 12 inches of mock neo-Nazi-garbed SS rough-trade chic, strode into the room and politely asked to be shown the cucumbers in a manner reminiscent of Henry Irving at Agincourt. "Now grit the teeth and wet the microtome. If tea party there be, let cucumber be slivered to the thinnest with precision and pressed twixt finest slices of good bread." Exits left into kitchen. Starfeast 24-hour caterpersons were not allowed to interfere with their grotesque Californian ways in the preparation of this most English of occasions. The therapy was underway. In the kitchen, bread was already being thinly sliced with the sharpest of knives, dipped in 211 Fahrenheitist water by Deitch Helmer, a Russian-Jewish princess and session-singing, side-saddle-riding veterinarian's assistant, while in another corner of the room, a grinning, momentarily apostate tunesmith son of Sid Charisse was mixing some elixir grimdikii, its influence pervading the very atmosphere. Zzzz rustled the doorbell, heralding the arrival and swift, starlight-assisted admittance of Barbara and Dr. Timothy Leary. The blissful couple appeared to have attained glitnia, yimuzvara, call it what you will, but they had definitely uncoiled kundalini right up past their sahasraras. They had eschewed years of meditation in lotus posture, tedious attempts at withdrawing attention from perceptual cognition, and weeks of leafing through back numbers of Self-Realization magazine, and had achieved the same Elysian state by the use of chemical additives. As the couple glid past, Timothy's blue-grey eyes gazed with radium-like luster into something that might well be described as eternity. Their three children, seeing something they wanted in the garden, stampeded earthily over the grand piano, through a token bevy of uninvited journalists, across the lawn, leapt over the recumbent naked form of a friend of David Hockney, and straight into the pool fully clothed. "Isn't that George Lazenby over there, seeing enjoying a can of specially imported Foster's lager? What, do you mean behind Christopher Isherwood and Georgia Brown, seen there enjoying a joke with Ian Lefrenet?" queried the second token journalist. "Yes, between Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, Beau Diddley and the piano, seen over there enjoying a brief rest in a tight schedule. Who's that with Hollywood psychiatrist Dr. Stuart Lerner?" "It could be either Jane Seymour, Jenny Aguta, Susan George, Shelley Duvall or Victor Borger." "Victor Borger? Sorry, did I say Victor Borger? Only I also thought I caught sight of Victor Borger enjoying a quiet word with Charlton Chuck Heston and screenwriter companion Alan Katz." "Yes, but who's that girl with Stuart Lerner?" "Ah, that's Sylvia Christel." "Oh." The sun dappled its way through the trees, spilling onto the crisp white linen of the tea table which ran the full length of the garden. Cucumber sandwiches were passed. Tea was poured from silver pots into bone china, and the soft clop of croquet mallet hitting ball wafted across the lawn. A token journalist 4 yards away thought the party was in full swing, and I could hear the distant drone of Bernard McKenna throwing up after his second bottle of bourbon. Thank heavens we had given him his own quarters. "Everyone seems to be occupied," I thought, as I slipped through the guests, nodded to Burt Reynolds' chauffeur, and stepped discreetly through a side door into the waiting presidential limo. Now for phase two. It was, coincidentally, David Frost's 40th birthday party, his third that afternoon, and I'd promised to try and look in for a moment or two. I'm glad I did, for there, in the main ballroom, seated at the top table, completely surrounded by journalists, was David Paradine Frost. David was so preoccupied that he was unaware that table upon table of celebrities, to grace this magnificent occasion, had sent along cardboard cutouts of themselves. There sat an effigy of Peter Sellers. At another table, a photograph of James Coburn chatted to an image of Dick Van Dyke. Between them, one could see the outline of Andy Williams standing in for a silhouette of Ray Stevens. Mary Tyler Moore, Jane Fonda, Gabe Kaplan, Victor Borger and David Niven had arrived as a group shot, and David thanked a two-dimensional Henry Kissinger for his thoughtful gift of 24 fresh sycophants, and even more effusively thanked one of his secretaries for having had the absolutely superbly fantastic and original idea of inviting his mother along. Then, almost as if on cue, a singing telegram arrived. A refugee from a Busby Berkeley musical mawked her way through a cloying paean of praise for David's unique achievement. This was followed by a dancing telegram, followed by a dancing and singing telegram, then a dancing singing telegram on roller skates dressed like a birthday cake. David even managed to feign surprise when a fifth telegram, a roller skating, shouting, singing comedy duo, arrived. For once, David had made a slight miscalculation. Even his synthesized smile showed signs of sagging, fortunately perking up professionally for each photographic flash. Luckily, Peter Sellers' cardboard cutout had lost interest in the proceedings, and I was able to make my exit hiding behind it as it excused itself on the grounds of ill health. It had apparently been bitten on the shin by a tiger whilst skiing. On the way out, I consoled an agitated Rod Stewart, who unfortunately had to come to the party in person. He'd only got married that morning, and the blow-ups of the happy couple could not be processed in time. A Carmen Mirandettel host person with eerily nude legs assisted me to my seat in the Starminder Sitem Easy limo loader. As I was glidden hydraulically to my seat in the presidential limo, through the darkened glass I caught a glimpse of Peter's cutout being loaded with intensive care into a Rolls-Royce Silver Cloud Fantambulance. I pressed the audio off switch on the colour TV and settled back to listen to Dr. Bowie's Kooks on the car's septemphonic sound system. Took a can of Diet Loganberry Shasta from the bar and sipped at it between puffs of a jay of Antarctic beige, nibbling sporadically from a plastic bag full of mushrooms. As we fluoresced our way westward along sunset past a shimmering Chateau Marmont, another limo glowed alongside. Its sunroof slid back, and a figure stood up to wave cheerily at some ladies with long legs standing outside the body shop. It was Eric Idle. I pressed the raise button on my armrest and went up to the sun deck position. Eric had disappeared inside. I told the driver to get me his number and picked up the handset. Seconds later, I heard the phone ring in the next-door car. After the usual pleasantries of, "Hello, Eric, hello, Graham, what are you on?" had been exchanged, he and Ricky Fatang and Penelope Elm crossed over on their limo loader. "Would you all like to come to a party at my place later on?" I asked, as I passed round a brown paper bag filled with cookies and poured them large vodkas on the rocks. "I think we're already at one," replied Eric. "George said he'd try and drop by, and I know Harry and Richard are going to be there." "All right, see you later," said Eric. "It's okay if we bring Keith and Ron, isn't it?" "Sure, okay, see you later. I'm just going to nip off down through Boys Town on the way back. I want to pick up some Zoom." "I bet that's not all," twinkled Eric.
It was dark as I and a few guests I'd found en route at a party in the Polo Lounge arrived back at 203 Bristol Avenue North. A young Texan, an Irish choir boy, and a Thai bus boy called Bum were not among them. Van Dyke Parks greeted me with, "We all love your style, Graham, and to me that's as important as ducks in June." I agreed wholeheartedly and went into the main room. It must have been something I'd eaten. The house seemed to be full of an assemblage of images, sounds, and smells, and other sensations, mediated through a spot 2 inches behind the nape of my neck and all the way up the inside of my trousers. I stared at people, hoping that they wouldn't notice how strange they looked to me. Normally, this didn't bother me. I'd probably been smoking too much. Harry Nilsson was at the piano performing a duet with a barking robot dog. Ringo then led a rendition of Happy Birthday to You, accompanied by 25 lead vocalists who just happened to be there, and countless session singers, a gift from Warner Brothers. Harry and Marty Feldman added a touch of Keith Moon by using the top of the piano as a drum kit. My mother and father hovered in a state of enlightened astonishment at having found yet another black man who was very well spoken, you know. Taking a cue from Marty, who was by now chasing Hollywood psychiatrist Stuart Lerner around the room trying to embarrass him with a French kiss, I chatted up the nearest sex symbol, Sylvia Christel. telling her to pop in and see Bernard McKenna, who I felt needed a sexual threat to slow down his rapidly developing affair with a gallon of bourbon. She returned a few minutes later, her advances having been repelled by an in-flight ashtray. She wandered off into the garden to be consoled by a girlfriend. Tony Stratton Smith, first Earl of Lambourne elect, schoonered past beatifically, murmuring mantrilically, "Ah, Brazil, ah, Brazil, ah, Brazil." George Harrison, an island of purity, glowed nearby with a "Hello, Graham," and a self-realization fellowship wave. My mother didn't think that Ron Woods and Keith Richards should have been allowed into my bedroom, since they were Eric's guests, and she was very worried about whether those two girls were all right out there in the bushes. I let her worry away happily. Loretta Feldman told a bemused Eric how full of shit people could be in an explanatory bellow. Elton John appeared without his cap and spectacles, a bubbling, liberated, portly soul. Image followed image until early morning. The house was almost empty, but the drumming at the piano had resumed and continued till near dawn when Marty and Loretta left, leaving Harry, who couldn't understand people's lack of stamina, and called me a shit as I saw him firmly into his limo. "Yes, I am," seemed the appropriate reply. Out there at 6:30 a.m., he screamed at the top of his voice in the direction of Hollywood, exclaiming that it too was full of shit. I bellowed in agreement with my friend as his limo thuffed off down the drive towards the rising sun. Dr. Wanacross gave me a conspiratorial thumbs up from the bushes. Thankfully, I closed the door, and Star to Bed tuckers into the stars, no kids or animals, saw me to bed, not forgetting to clean my teeth. I fell asleep as a girl with brown knees finished chapter 9 of Biggles Grits His Thighs. The moon, yawned Algy opiningly, is rather a dull place, and all of us decided that we would definitely leave the following Tuesday. Even at 1/6G, the pogo sticks had become a bore. The daily round of long-distance TV chat shows, panel games about extraterrestrial things, guest appearances on This Is Your Planet, all of which conveniently defy description, became about as interesting as breakfast at Tiffany's. It was Sunday afternoon, and the pubs were all shut. After an hour of sexual reminiscences about things none of us had ever done, we decided to have a farewell party. David made the cucumber sandwiches, John prepared James Grimsdyke's famous punch, and I slipped out in my beige spacesuit to see if the others would be prepared to pop along. The Beast and Anna Karenina were doing the hoovering, John Cleese's diary was absolutely chock-a-block, and Nostradamus had left a note on the door of his capsule saying, "I predict I'll be back about 8. I was about to give up, but thought, without much hope, I may as well call in on the Allies. Mrs. Alley was regurgitating masticated carrots into the champ's mouth as he was being rubbed down by his old space partner. "Can you come to our party?" I asked. "Man, I'd love to," he said, "but no, I can't." "Sorry about that," I said, "but why not? Look, I've spent 12 years building up this reputation of being a loud-mouthed buck nigger. Do you want me to spoil that by coming round to your place and being as intelligent as I really am?" "Yes, I suppose that would blow your cover a bit, old man," I said. "You bet, man." I stepped out nimbly through the airlock and deftly percolated past Elton John's piano-shaped moon buggy. He was obviously entertaining David Bowie and Ken Liberace, so I passed on. I knew the next space vehicle was occupied for an at-home evening by David Hockney and Alan Bennett, comparing the size of their accents, so I didn't bother with them. I then molested my way past J.B. Priestley, H.R.H. the Queen Mother, David Niven, please note, Peter Sellers, Britt Eklund, Carlo Ponti, Peter Cook, and Beau Dudley, A, but not the Dr. Jonathan Miller, H.R.H. the very dead Governor of New Zealand, Noel Coward, George Melly, and Larry and Jerry Durrell. Unfortunately, they all had slight chills that evening. Keith Moon, Richard Starkey, and Harry Nilsson were genuinely disappointed that they couldn't come, in that they weren't in the lunar regions at that time, but wished us all well. In desperation, I knocked on the hatch of a capsule made entirely of wood. There was no reply. I undid the mahogany latch on the huge teak door and approached the coffin. Engraved in the oak were the words, "Here lies Oscar Fingal O'Flaherty Wilde, gone out for good." I'd had enough excuses for one day. I wrenched open the Lombardy poplar lid with a noise resembling a loud rustle, which means nothing on Earth, but in outer space can often split your nose. I took hold of the dead wit's legs and dragged him back to my place. There is a time in the affairs of Grebes which, taken at the cludge, leads on to brutalness. A man is not a wasp, nor Dusseldorf built in a day. Damon Runyon had a bunion, and for awe they say, hey, aye. My heart bakes, a drowsy numbness fills my jensen. Let it be, let it be.
What's that supposed to mean? Asked David. It's not bad, he is dead, I said.
Oh, come on, he's dead, it's not bad.
No, come on, Wilde, what does that mean? Asked the Prince of Wales. It means, Your Majesty, it means...
The audience exploded into laughter. We all ran off stage and John Cleese hissed angrily into my ear, Learn your fucking lines, it should have been... You had us waiting for hours. Graham, faintly. I didn't think anyone noticed. John, even more faintly. No, I suppose they didn't. Graham, and still more faintly, the end.